Good morning and welcome to the Wednesday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. While moms do housework on weekends, what do dads do? Not much, study finds. By Amanda McMillan for Health.com. Parents of young children may or may not be surprised by a recent study that shows new dads spend more time relaxing than new moms. The study, published in the journal Sex Roles, found that in households in which both parents work, men tend to devote more of their days off to relaxing compared to women who spend them tending to childcare and housework. Researchers tracked what couples were doing minute by minute on their non-work days and found that when women were busy with kids or chores, men were often engaged in leisure activities. Men did help out with these tasks, but to a lesser extent, and when they did, their wives were generally also doing so as well. The study included 52 heterosexual couples living in Ohio, most of whom were white and well-educated. Lead author Claire Camp Douche, associate professor of human sciences at The Ohio State University, said she was surprised that even in middle to upper class families, the division of housework and childcare was so disproportionate. "I didn't really see that coming," says Camp Douche, who says she and her husband strive to share household responsibilities as equally as possible. "We expected these couples to have pretty egalitarian ideals about the way the division of labor should go, but those beliefs really aren't being practiced." The study participants all kept detailed diaries of what they were doing at different times of day and how long they spent doing certain activities, both on a work day and a non-work day. They completed this exercise both before and after their first child was born. Camp Douche and her colleagues found that 3 months after the babies were born, men spent about 101 minutes relaxing on their days off while their wives did some kind of child care or housework. Women, on the other hand, logged only half that time, 46 to 49 minutes in leisure, while their husbands had their hands full. The amount of time women and men spent doing housework and child care was more equal on work days, although women still got slightly less time to relax. On days off, though, Saturday and Sundays in many families, traditional gender inequalities emerged, the authors say. Women continued toiling away while men took the opportunity to kick back. The husbands in the study weren't necessarily doing this deliberately, says Camp Douche. "For future studies, we'd like to look at husbands' perceptions of how much work he's doing versus how much she's doing," she says. "I'd like to see if he perceives that he's doing a greater percentage than he really is." Women may also contribute to the uneven division of work, she adds, by choosing not to let their husbands handle certain responsibilities themselves. During some of these times, women may be hovering over their spouses and making sure they're doing things the quote-unquote right way, she says. "One piece of advice I have for women is to actually let him get in there and do the child care and the housework," she says. "There are lots of ways to dress a baby and change a diaper and fold laundry, and if it's not exactly your way, that's okay." But, she says, men need to do their part as well and make an effort to share the work when they see their partners are too busy to relax, especially when there's a new baby in the house. Surprisingly, men in the study actually logged twice as much leisure time on their days off after their child was born than they did before. Camp Douche acknowledges that her research involved a small homogeneous sample and that the findings certainly aren't representative of every couple. But she worries that household responsibilities may be even less equal among couples that don't have all the advantages as the ones in her study. Among her group of friends, she says women don't seem to be surprised by her study's findings. "The reaction has pretty much been, 'Duh, I could have told you that,' she says. 'I haven't heard from any defensive dads yet, but I imagine I will.'" She hopes the findings can help all couples, regardless of their personal arrangements with each other, to be more sensitive to the roles and responsibilities each member takes on in a relationship. "I know for me, it's really irritating to do housework when my husband is playing on his phone, and I know it's equally irritating for him when I do it," says Camp Douche. When you see your partner is really working hard, make sure you're really doing your part, too. This article originally appeared on Health.com.
This aerial photo shows what wildfires did to one California neighborhood by Eli Mixler. More than a dozen wildfires have devastated Northern California this week, laying waste to 1,500 buildings, injuring more than 100, and claiming 10 lives. Inflamed by powerful winds, 14 wildfires broke out overnight Sunday and racked the Napa and Sonoma valleys Monday, displacing thousands of Northern California residents. Two hospitals in Santa Rosa had to evacuate patients, and the death toll is expected to rise as the trail of devastation grows in what is already one of California's 10 most deadly fires. The Santa Rosa neighborhood of Coffee Park was among the worst-hit area, according to Business Insider, which published before and after images of the area in their all-stark contrast. The residential subdivision, built in the 1980s and home to about 8,000 residents, according to the San Francisco Chronicle, appears to have been completely razed. Aerial photos showed the neatly manicured neighborhoods with single-family homes clustered on tree-lined streets reduced to ash, with trails of smoke rising over a scorched dystopian landscape. An estimated 20,000 people were evacuated because of the blaze, the Associated Press reports, while four of the six shelters operating in Santa Rosa are at capacity, according to the Santa Rosa Fire Department.
These five iPhone apps prove augmented reality isn't just hype. By Lisa Adisico. In a flashy presentation at its Worldwide Developers Conference this June, Apple discussed the potential augmented reality holds for the iPhone. When you bring these things together, the results can actually be quite profound, Apple's Vice President of Software Engineering, Craig Federighi, said in reference to the iPhone's touchscreen and camera, the two elements that are most crucial for providing AR experiences. Federighi was unveiling ARKit, a set of tools Apple released for developers with iOS 11 to make creating augmented reality apps for iPhones and iPads much easier. Augmented reality is a technology that allows your phone to mix real-world surroundings with what's being shown on screen using the device's camera. It's how, for example, a game like Pokemon Go is able to make it look like Monster Pal Squirtle is standing on your nightstand or on the sidewalk, not just floating in space disengaged. The first wave of ARKit-powered apps has been available for 3 weeks since iOS 11 debuted on September 19th. As with early websites and mobile apps, AR experiences at this point aren't as profound or polished as Apple would have you believe. Some still take too long to detect a flat surface, while others feel more like Me Too trend following, as developers struggle to figure out how best to avail themselves of the new technology. Should you delve into any of these at this point? I've explored several and found a handful that, while imperfect, offer compelling glimpses of how AR could eventually rewrite the ways in which we'll be able to transform reality through our smart devices. JigSpace. Video tutorials and photos can be helpful for learning about specific subjects, but as the viewer, you have little control over the angles at which you can observe the scene. If you're watching a video to learn about NASA's Mars Curiosity rover, for example, you can only catch glimpses of the vehicle, and it can be difficult to fully visualize how it operates. It's a problem JigSpace hopes to solve. The app includes a small library of animated 3D graphics with accompanying text that you can explore to learn how certain objects function. After selecting a tutorial, such as how a piano works, the app will scan your surroundings for a flat surface that it can virtually place the object on. Once it's done this, you can pinch to zoom in on the graphic, then rotate it to view it from any angle. The app selection is currently limited, with just 4 sections and 26 tutorials or jigs, but it illustrates how AR can be employed to offer immediately useful experiences that don't feel gimmicky. Tap measure. Smartphones have supplanted tools like calculators, wristwatches, flashlights, and numerous other utilitarian gadgets. But one they haven't is the tape measure. That's about to change with AR. And ARKit apps like Tap Measure exemplify why smartphones are about to become essential tools for depth sensing and other forms of digital measurement. Tap Measure is incredibly simple to use. Just tap the button that appears on screen to set your starting point, move your phone along the surface you'd like to measure, then press the button again to set your endpoint. The app uses your iPhone's camera to help with other forms of measurements too, offering tools for leveling picture frames and generating 3D scans of rooms. Fitness AR. Holographic maps like those shown in The Hunger Games are still futuristic fantasies, but AR is unlocking new ways of viewing locational data. Take Fitness AR, an app that integrates with fitness social network Strava, so that you can visualize runs and bike routes in 3D. Fitness AR creates a 3D map of paths you've logged in the app that's viewable from multiple vantage points. You can zoom in to get a closer look and scout potential courses using the Fitness AR's route building option. As AR technology improves, I imagine a tool like this helping athletes who want to enhance their performance by studying the terrain on previous routes, focusing on areas during which they struggled. Vuforia Chalk. If you're the go-to IT expert in your family, PTC Inc.'s Vuforia Chalk app is both a blessing and a curse. It makes explaining instructions to someone remotely easier, which in turn increases the likelihood you'll be getting calls from exasperated family members. With Vuforia Chalk, you can share your device's view of something with someone else to discuss a problem, say which button to push on a remote or how to operate a homemade cappuccino maker. The two of you can then annotate the screen to pass along or comment on directions in real time. The app uses augmented reality to make sure those markups stay in place as you move your phone's camera around the space. Quartz. News outlets are constantly evolving their storytelling formats to keep up with new technologies, and Quartz's mobile app is a great example of this. When receiving conversational news tidbits from Quartz's app, certain stories include an option to view the contents in augmented reality. A story about Tesla's Model 3, for example, might be accompanied by a 3D graphic of the car, which readers can then examine from multiple perspectives. It's going to take time for news publishers and app developers to find the best uses for augmented reality, but Quartz's approach is a promising start.
Gwyneth Paltrow, Angelina Jolie, and others come forward with sexual misconduct allegations against Harvey Weinstein. By Samantha Cooney. Allegations against Harvey Weinstein continue to pile up. In new reports, three women say that the Hollywood producer sexually assaulted them, while Gwyneth Paltrow and Angelina Jolie came forward with their own allegations of sexual harassment against the mogul. The new claims hit Tuesday in two separate pieces by The New Yorker and The New York Times, coming just days after The Times bombshell report on decades of sexual harassment allegations against the former co-chairman of the Weinstein Company and the founder of Miramax. Weinstein was fired from his role as co-chairman of the Weinstein Company. Actors Rosanna Arquette and Mira Sorvino have also come forward with their own sexual harassment allegations against Weinstein, while a number of celebrities who have previously worked with the mogul, including Meryl Streep and Judi Dench, have spoken out against his alleged behavior. The New Yorker investigation, written by Ronan Farrow, includes the stories of two women, Asia Argento and Lucia Evans, who say that Weinstein forced oral sex on them, while an unnamed woman alleged that Weinstein forced himself on me sexually. Four others told The New Yorker that Weinstein touched them without their consent. That could be classified as an assault, according to The New Yorker. In total, 13 women, including actors Mira Sorvino and Rosanna Arquette, told the magazine about allegations of sexual harassment or misconduct. The story also includes new audio from an NYPD sting operation, which Weinstein appears to admit to groping actor Ambra Batalana Gutierrez, who first came forward with allegations that the producer groped her in 2015. Later on Tuesday, The New York Times published a new story in which Paltrow, Jolie, and a number of others accused Weinstein of harassment. The following women have accused Weinstein. A spokesman for Weinstein issued similar statements to The New Yorker and The New York Times, denying the allegations of sexual harassment. Any allegations of non-consensual sex are unequivocally denied by Mr. Weinstein. Mr. Weinstein has further confirmed that there was never any acts of retaliation against any woman for refusing his advances. Mr. Weinstein obviously can't speak to anonymous allegations, but with respect to any women who have made allegations on the record, Mr. Weinstein believes that all of these relationships were consensual. Mr. Weinstein has begun counseling, has listened to the community, and is pursuing a better path. Mr. Weinstein is hoping that, if he makes enough progress, he will be given a second chance, spokesman Sally Hoffmeister said in the statement to The New Yorker. Gwyneth Paltrow, the actor and entrepreneur who has starred in a number of Weinstein's films and won an Oscar for her role in Miramax's Shakespeare in Love, told the New York Times that after she was hired to star in Emma, he asked her to meet at the Peninsula Hotel. Weinstein placed his hands on her and suggested they give each other massages, according to Paltrow. She said she refused his advances, and he threatened her not to tell anyone else about the encounter, though she told her then-boyfriend Brad Pitt, who says she later confronted Weinstein. Angelina Jolie. In an email to the Times, she said that she had a bad experience with Harvey Weinstein in my youth and refused to work with him again. This behavior towards women in any field, any country, is unacceptable, she said. Asia Argento. In 1997, the then 21-year-old actor, who'd appeared in Miramax's Bee Monkey, told The New Yorker that she was invited to a party being thrown by Miramax, but she was instead taken to a hotel room that was empty except for Weinstein. After she reluctantly agreed to give him a massage, she claims that he then began to perform oral sex on her without her consent. Argento said that Weinstein continued to contact her and that she eventually had consensual encounters with him over a period of 5 years. Lucia Evans. After meeting Weinstein in 2004, Evans told The New Yorker that he would call her up at night to ask for meetings. Evans declined until he had his assistant schedule daytime meetings with Weinstein and a female casting executive. She said that at the meeting, he forced her to perform oral sex on him. Mira Sorvino. The actor, who won an Oscar for her role in Miramax's Mighty Aphrodite, told The New Yorker that she ended up in a hotel room with Weinstein at the 1995 Toronto International Film Festival, where he gave her a massage and then tried to get more physical. She left the room after telling him that she didn't date married men. She said that Weinstein showed up at her apartment after midnight weeks later, but she got him to leave after telling him her boyfriend was on his way. Rosanna Arquette, the actor who appeared in Weinstein's Pulp Fiction, told The New Yorker that she was directed to the producer's hotel room when she arrived for a planned dinner at the Beverly Hills Hotel in the 1990s. Weinstein asked for a massage, which she declined. He then grabbed her hands and attempted to guide them toward his penis before she declined. Arquette's sister Patricia has spoken out against Weinstein since the publication of the New York Times investigation. Arquette also discussed her experience with The Times. Emma de Kun. In 2010, the French actor met Weinstein for lunch, she told The New Yorker, where he told her about a role in a book adaptation he was working on. He told her the book was up in his hotel room, she says, and after initially resisting, she agreed to go up to his room. She claims that Weinstein got naked and told her to lie down on the bed. Jessica Barth. The actor told The New Yorker that in 2011, Weinstein invited her to a business meeting at the Peninsula Hotel so they could discuss her career privately. She claims that he discussed giving her a role in a new film and asked her to give him a naked massage in bed. When she attempted to leave, he told her that she needed to lose weight if she wanted to make it, Barth said. Tomi Ann Roberts. Roberts, now a psychology professor at Colorado College, told The Times she met Weinstein when she was working as a waitress in New York over summer break. She said Weinstein encouraged her to pursue a career in acting and invited her to a hotel room, where he was allegedly nude in the bathtub and told her she needed to be comfortable showing her body. She left the room. Catherine Kendall. After a daytime business meeting, the actor told The Times that Weinstein asked her to come to his apartment so he could pick something up. He emerged in a bathrobe and asked her to give him a massage, telling her, "Everybody does it," according to The Times. She refused. Judith Godrèche, the French actor, told The Times she went up to Weinstein's hotel suite after a business meeting to discuss a marketing and Oscar campaign for a film they worked on. She said Weinstein asked her to give him a massage and that he then was pressing against me and pulling off my sweater. She left the room and called a female Miramax executive who advised her to keep quiet. Dawn Dunning. The aspiring actor met Weinstein at a nightclub in 2003, according to The Times. She was invited to a business meeting at his hotel, where she was directed to go up to his suite. She said Weinstein was in a bathrobe and told her he would allow her to sign contracts for his next three films if she agreed to have a threesome with him. She refused.
It looked like the apocalypse. California residents watch in horror as wildfires destroy their homes. By Melissa Chan. Eduardo Flores and his wife could only stare in shock as a massive fireball swallowed their longtime home in Santa Rosa, California, within minutes. The Army veteran had woken up to use the bathroom about 1 a.m. Monday when he saw a blood-red sky outside. The wildfires that would leave at least 13 people dead and more than 1,000 homes destroyed in California's wine country had reached his front door. "It was literally raining fire. We were choking, gasping for air," he told Time on Tuesday. Flores rushed outside to warn his sleeping neighbors in the Journey's End mobile home park. He hammered on their doors with his fists and smashed their windows while screaming. 10 minutes later, he and his wife grabbed their dog, left all their belongings behind, and made their way to a nearby hospital, where they climbed to the third-tier parking lot. They had an aerial view of the destruction. "We were watching unit by unit by unit burn down," said Flores, 66. "We just stood there in shock. It was so fast. My house just burned down in front of me." Flores, who served in Vietnam, said the raging fire, worsened by high winds and exploding containers of propane and gasoline in the trailer park, brought him back to the war. "It was like napalm," he said. "It was like a bad flashback." Flores and his wife lost everything they owned, including passports, birth certificates, photos, and a 160-year-old blanket his great-great-grandmother had woven. They're staying at a group home in Santa Rosa, where his paraplegic sister lives for now. But Flores, a mental health care worker, still feels relatively lucky. "By the grace of God, we got out with our lives," he said. About 3 miles away, in Coffee Park, Lynn Dorsey and her husband Bill also ran for their lives around 1 a.m. Monday when nearby homes became engulfed in flames. "There were embers and sparks raining down from our backyard," she said. "It looked like the apocalypse." The Dorseys drove to safety and spent the night at a friend's house. 9 hours later, they headed back home, hoping the two-story, four-bedroom house they had lived in for more than 2 decades was still standing. But it had burned down, along with more than a dozen other homes in the neighborhood. "I said, 'No, no, no, this is not happening to us,'" Lynn Dorsey, 58, recalled, breaking down in tears. "It was like a war zone. It looks like an atomic bomb was dropped with everything leveled." Instead of their home, which had always been filled with music and laughter, there were piles of ashes. "It was like standing in a burned-down forest," Bill Dorsey said. "I can't stop crying. It's so overwhelming. It's sort of numbing." 7 Daily Habits Extremely Successful People Swear By, by Paul Schrote. How do you become an uber-rich mogul in the vein of Bill Gates or Oprah Winfrey? Well, it might help to emulate the way they operate in their day-to-day lives. Success, after all, requires not just luck and skill, but also a certain mindset. If you're distracted, you won't be able to reach the goals needed to get where you want to be, whether that means starting your own company or excelling at what you already do. Many famously wealthy and successful people have shared some of the rituals they practice to stay on the right track. We rounded up some of their habits you might want to pick up on. They read a lot, and mostly nonfiction. Tom Corley, an accountant and financial planner, surveyed 233 wealthy individuals, mostly self-made millionaires, and found interesting patterns among them. A huge majority of these rich people, 88%, say they devote 30 minutes or more each day to reading, according to CNBC. Most of those prefer nonfiction works like biographies, history, and self-help books. Billionaire investment guru Warren Buffett reportedly once said that reading is the most important habit he has picked up. "I just sit in my office and read all day," he told The Week. They meditate to clear their heads and stay sharp. Meditation isn't just for yoga nuts. Research has found that meditation has mental and physical benefits, including improving memory. Twitter and Square CEO Jack Dorsey wakes up at 5 a.m. every morning and immediately meditates. Oprah is a fan of the practice, too. They get up early. Nearly 50% of the wealthy people researched by Corley, who wrote the book Change Your Habits, Change Your Life, say they wake up at least 3 hours before their workday starts. Many use the time to tackle side projects, work out, or plan. So if you're hitting snooze until you have to drag yourself to the office, you might want to rethink your strategies. But they also manage to sleep a lot. Albert Einstein said he needed 10 hours of sleep a night to function at his best. Millionaire media maven Arianna Huffington has preached sleep as a performance enhancer. Corley found that 89% of self-made millionaires sleep 7 or 8 hours a night, or even more. Sleep is critical to success, he wrote. They make time for exercise. Hitting the gym regularly doesn't just help you get vanity muscles. Research shows that the kind of working out that gets your heart and your sweat glands pumping, according to Harvard Health Publishing, actually improves memory and learning. Corley reports that 76% of his wealthy survey respondents say they spend 30 minutes or more each day on aerobic exercise, like running or biking. Billionaire Richard Branson even claims that staying fit doubles his productivity. They're consciously working on their communication skills. Lifehack distilled self-help principles in an article and found that highly successful people are clear communicators, and they're constantly trying to get better. Spending your day with data and facts doesn't do much good if you can't translate the information to people around you. Branson has said that communication is the most important skill any leader can possess. In a blog post on the value of communication, he quoted self-help author Brian Tracy saying, "If you're willing to work at it, you can rapidly improve the quality of every part of your life, including talking to themselves." Michael Stawicki, author of Directed by Purpose, says that in his research on success, he's found that high-performing individuals have running conversations with themselves. That doesn't necessarily mean muttering to yourself, though. What allows them to beat their opponents is not more time spent honing their skills, but more focus on perfecting their internal dialogue, Stawicki said. Research has found that talking to yourself can help you see situations objectively and motivate you.
Here's how President Trump's tax plan would affect you, by Chris Wilson and David Johnson. The Trump administration is moving on to its next big policy fight, dramatically reshaping the tax code. For now, the White House plan, branded as the Unified Framework for Fixing Our Broken Tax Code, is only a loose set of ideas and principles, with many of the specifics still set to be filled in later. In general, the plan would eliminate a number of specific deductions for individual taxpayers in favor of encouraging more Americans to take the standard deduction, and it would end some taxes that hit the richest individuals the most, according to an initial analysis by the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center. Still, you can get a good sense of how the plan will affect you by answering a few simple questions about how you currently pay your taxes. Head to Time.com and take our 6-question quiz to find out. Ivanka Trump, DACA Needs a Long-Term Fix, by Tessa Berenson. Ivanka Trump said Monday that she thinks there needs to be a long-term congressional fix to protect beneficiaries of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. "This is a very complicated issue that needs a long-term congressional fix," Trump said at the Fortune Most Powerful Women Summit in Washington. "I personally am of the opinion, and the president has stated this, that we have to figure out a good solution that protects these innocent people, many of whom were brought to the country as children." DACA is an Obama-era policy that shielded around 700,000 immigrants brought illegally to the country as children from deportation. The Trump administration announced in September that it would end. President Trump has since been working on a deal with Democrats in Congress on a legislative solution that could allow Dreamers to avoid deportation. But the White House's new list of demands on immigration could hamper the negotiations. "There has to be a long-term fix," Ivanka Trump continued. "It can't be bandaged over on a presidential level by another executive order." 7 Moments That Shaped the President's Role as Comforter-in-Chief, by Barbara A. Perry. Nowhere are a president's persuasive abilities more necessary and the people more receptive to them than in the aftermath of a tragedy. But why do we expect a partisan political figure to soothe our nation's jangled nerves after a disaster? The answers lie in the nature of the office, the men who have held it, modern public grieving rituals, and contemporary media culture, but also in the cumulative impact of crises and the expanding demands on presidents as power has accrued to them. The president becomes the father figure. Ever since George Washington earned the designation Father of Our Country from his earliest days as Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army, we've seen our nation's chief executives as paternal, even priestly symbols. Secular and religious fathers are expected to comfort their families and flocks during crises. The president becomes the unifier. Lincoln, known as Father Abraham, not only saved the Union, but also tried to bind up the nation's wounds as he looked toward the Civil War's end, aiming to reunite Americans split asunder by the Confederacy's 1861 secession. Named for Abraham, the biblical prophet, Lincoln also established the gold standard for presidential eulogies at Gettysburg in 1863. He elegantly embraced the office's dual roles as both the head of government and the head of state. Unlike a prime minister who leads the government while a monarch or president performs ceremonial duties, an American president embodies the obligations of ruler and sovereign. From pardoning the Thanksgiving turkey each year, an idea that was formalized under President George H.W. Bush in 1989, to leading somber national mourning services, the president presides over the rituals that constitute American national tradition. The president becomes the voice of the nation. As the only nationally elected official, a president speaks for the country at home and abroad. In 1936, the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed this role in foreign affairs via its opinion in U.S. v. Curtis Wright Export Corporation, noting that the Founding Fathers vested the president, FDR in this case, with foreign policy power so that he might provide unified statements for the nation. The president becomes the subject of grief. Because we view them as the head of our national family, we mark their passing, especially if sudden and violent, with an outpouring of emotion. The deaths of incumbents Lincoln, Garfield, McKinley, FDR, and JFK prompted public sorrow and private upset. Researchers discovered after John F. Kennedy's 1963 assassination that many Americans suffered the same symptoms evident when a close family member dies: uncontrolled crying, sleeplessness, loss of appetite. When our anchor in times of tragedy becomes the victim of it, we feel adrift and look to the new president to reestablish our moorings. President Lyndon Johnson's brief remarks on the Andrews Air Force Base tarmac just after the nation watched JFK's casket removed from Air Force One, followed by Mrs. Kennedy in her blood-stained suit, provided a necessary balm for the shocked nation. Emotion becomes acceptable. In modern times, the stiff upper lip has become anachronistic. After public tragedies, memorials of flowers, balloons, teddy bears, and signs proliferate. Perhaps the best example of this lesson comes from across the pond. Woe to the head of state who fails to join in public grieving rituals, as Queen Elizabeth II discovered after Princess Diana's untimely death in 1997. In contrast, President Bill Clinton's genuine union with the survivors of the 1995 federal building bombing in Oklahoma City actually resurrected his presidency. Modern communications and travel accelerate the timeline. When the Titanic sank in 1912, President William Howard Taft received very few details initially, including that his military aide and dear friend Major Archibald Butt had perished aboard the doomed ship. Taft issued a heartfelt statement about his beloved staffer, but wasn't expected to meet with survivors. Presidents now learn about tragic events instantaneously and can travel to the scene effortlessly, and American knowledge of tragedies is widespread. Victims' faces confront us at every turn, and families tell intimate stories of their loved ones taken all too soon. President George W. Bush's unforgettable appearance atop a collapsed fire engine at New York City's smoldering World Trade Center ruins in 2001 inspired first responders, victims' families, and a stunned nation, especially when he ad-libbed through a bullhorn, "I can hear you, the rest of the world can hear you, and the people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon." 24/7 coverage and social media proliferate. The same technology that delivers these tragedies directly to our homes and smartphones has become the conduit for instantaneous presidential condolence messages. Within a few hours of the Las Vegas massacre, President Donald Trump tweeted, "My warm condolences and sympathies to the victims and families of the terrible Las Vegas shooting. God bless you." Visits to cities and towns devastated by natural and man-made disasters soon follow. When Mother Nature wreaks havoc, victims expect presidents to arrive with tangible federal assistance. It's politically wise for chief executives to make the optics of these visits work, and missing the mark on those moments can have broad repercussions. Photos of George W. Bush flying over the Katrina-ravaged Gulf Coast in 2005 haunted his presidency. As media bombard Americans with the facts of human tragedies, those at the site and throughout the nation demand that the president help ease their pain. A secular liturgy has formed around the modern presidential response. A formal condolence statement from the White House, followed by a sacramental ritual of visiting survivors and victims' loved ones and participating in public memorials. Clinton in Oklahoma City and Obama in Tucson, Newtown, Charleston, and Orlando epitomized modern presidential outreach to salve the nation's wounds. If the president speaks poetically and delivers his lines to perfection, as with Reagan's memorable 1986 farewell to the Space Shuttle Challenger's victims, his words will resonate and comfort forever. "They slipped the surly bonds of earth and touched the face of God," Reagan said. Barbara A. Perry is Presidential Studies Director at the University of Virginia's Miller Center, a nonpartisan think tank focused on the presidency. 10 Drinks You Should Never Order at a Bar by Alana Akhtar. People put a lot of thought into the drinks they order at a bar, whether it's because they want to present a certain image to their friends, cultivate a certain mystique, or just get the most booze for their buck. There are other pitfalls to watch for, though. Some drinks are sneaky diet busters. Others make it easier for unscrupulous bartenders to take financial advantage. Some dive bar options can even be downright dangerous. If you want a fun night out but don't want it to burn a hole in your wallet or pack on extra pounds, here are the drinks you should absolutely stay away from. Number 1. Mojitos. Mojitos may seem like a harmless, sophisticated, refreshing beverage order, but the drink could be carrying bacteria from spoiled mint leaves. The problem, says Adam Levy, writer of the popular blog The Alcohol Professor, is that bars don't serve too many mojitos, so it's rare they keep fresh mint on deck. Fresh mint only lasts about a week, so chances are your $4 mojito special isn't serving the freshest quality garnish. Number 2. White Russians. There's another spoilage issue here. Cocktails like White Russians are made with cream or milk, ingredients that don't keep very long, and something that bars often forget to restock. New York City bartender and comedian Timothy Dunn says since bars don't use dairy products too often, chances are the cream's expired and could even be close to turning sour. Ick! Number 3. Frozen drinks. Frozen drinks may be a summertime staple, but they also pack on the calories. The drinks tend to be filled with sugar juices and mixers and served in huge glasses, typically larger than an average serving size, says Kerry Gans, the author of The Small Change Diet. If you need one to perfect your beach photo for Instagram, fine, but make it an occasional treat. Number 4. Draft beers in a dirty bar. Should you order draft beer at a bar? Dunn shares the secret way he makes the call. Check the bar's bathrooms. His logic? Bars that don't clean their bathrooms regularly may not be maintaining their keg lines either, and it's best to avoid drinking contaminated beer at all costs, he warns. Number 5. A Bloody Mary. Long known as a hangover cure, the Bloody Mary, or for that matter any other drink that uses Tabasco sauce, could actually be harmful for your health. Even many experienced bartenders may not know how to use Tabasco in drinks, Levy explains, and a heavy touch could add too much spice, which could overwhelm some people's digestive systems. It could really be a harmful drink, he says. Number 6. Red Bull and, well, pretty much any booze. Another set of health hazards attend any drink mixed with Red Bull. The sweet, fizzy energy drink may mask both the taste of liquor and the feeling of being drunk, making it easier for you to overindulge. Alcohol is a depressant and caffeine is a stimulant, Pittsburgh-based dietitian Leslie Bonsi said. The caffeine negates the inebriation effect of alcohol, and people end up drinking far more than they should. Number 7. Long Island Iced Teas. Avoiding this tornado of half a dozen different liquors and colas may seem like a no-brainer to anyone out of college, but another reminder to stay away couldn't hurt. The lethal combination contains well above the suggested alcohol quantity that anyone should consume per hour, says Bonsi. Plus, while the recipes vary depending on the bar, some could have as many as 780 calories, explains Jenna Braddock, dietitian and blogger at Make Health Easy. There's also a third risk, points out alcohol professor Levy. You look like an idiot drinking it over age 25. Number 8. Gin and Tonic. Even this commonly ordered drink can carry a surprising amount of calories. Blame the mixer. Although people often think tonic's a healthy choice, it looks like water after all, the fizzy drink actually has about 124 calories per serving from sugar, bartender Dunn notes. He suggests a good workaround. Get your liquor with soda water and then ask for a splash of tonic for the tart taste. Number 9. Shots. These may be fun to bring out for birthdays or a bachelorette party, but they're also sneaky ways for bars to charge you more for less alcohol. Shot glasses are made to look like an optical illusion, Dunn explains. The weight or height of a fancy glass may give you the impression you're getting a lot of liquid, but many bars use shot glasses that hold less volume than the standard 2 ounces. Dunn suggests you order straight liquor neat. It's the same drink, but you'll probably get more of it. And number 10, any drink that comes with cheap or free bar food. Alcohol itself serves up plenty of empty calories, but if you pair it with bar food like mozzarella sticks or tortilla chips, you'll quickly wind up consuming a huge amount of calories with little to no nutritional benefit. Being tipsy lowers your sense of inhibition, Bonsi warns, meaning you're more likely to say, "What the hey," and order that plate of nachos that the waitress is offering. The temptation intensifies if the bar offers happy hour deals or free food on the table. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.